There actually is a funny story about that. I guess it was 4 years ago, 3 years ago.
Oh, wait, I think.
So Angie Maxwell and I are teaching a class with former Senator David Pryor, and we were talking to him about some of the things that we wanted to do in the Blair Center. And he suggested that we go down and talk to the folks at the Rockefeller Institute, because a lot of the things that we were talking to him about, he had heard similar things from them as well. And we had a student in the class who also happened to be interning at the Rockefeller Institute. And working with her and with Senator Pryor, we made a trip down there and kind of – I mean, I think that the first trip was more of just a discussion, mm-hmm. and then they were intrigued enough that they said, please put together a proposal. When we went down, when Angie and I went down the second time, Margaret Reed, who's the chair of the Political Science Department, and Pearl Ford, who's also in the Blair Center and also part of African American Studies, went down, and it was just the four of us, wasn't it?
It was the four of us. Mm-hmm.
And we made a formal presentation, and the Rockefeller board was there, and Mrs. Rockefeller was there, and so it was a little bit intimidating, but, you know, not looking at nodding heads and smiles, we thought, no, I think they liked it. But then even before we made it back, they had called and said, you're funded. We're really excited about this. And
we almost drove off the road. We were so excited.
Now, there are a lot of political polls that are out there, the Gallup, the Pew, and several others, you know, even news media outlets also conduct their own individual polls. But what is so different about this one?
Well, first, it's an academic survey and not just a quick Gallup, you know, political poll, which means it goes really in depth. And I guess what's really interesting from our perspective and how we got Rockefeller to fund it is that there's very few national polls that have a large enough sample from the South to actually really talk about the South with any kind of authority or statistical authority. And so we said, what, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a national poll with a big enough sample nationally and of the South that you could actually compare the two and see if there really are any distinctive characteristics in the South. And that was kind of the hook that led to the poll being funded and why it's really different than many other polls out there. I mean, a good national sample is about 1,000. Mm-hmm. We've got 3,400. And not only do we have this oversample of the South, but we have a huge oversample of African Americans and Latinos, half of which took the survey in Spanish. It's just very, very, very extensive.
Mm-hmm. For me, there's, you know, the distinctiveness of this poll goes back to graduate school. And I took a class from a guy named Malcolm Jewell who wrote a lot about Southern politics. And he was good friends with Diane Blair, too. And in class, he would lament that there just weren't any surveys that allowed you any leverage to talk about the South with any kind of authority. And, you know, even by the time I had become tenured and chairing the political science department, that didn't change. Was really talking about white South.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So even if you wanted to look at women in the South or African Americans in the South or Latinos in the South, not to mention gender differences between Latinos and African Americans, mm-hmm. and, you know, you just couldn't disaggregate the data that much.
And the only thing that gets anywhere close is something like the census, but it doesn't ask any questions about racial views towards other groups and mm-hmm. public policy
or
preferences.
Party identification.
Most of the time people decide, I'm going to study the South or I'm going to study this issue in the South. And they just put that kind of artificial geographic boundary on it and never look outside the region to say, was it any different anywhere else? Mm-hmm. Is this a unique problem? Or did you just draw a box around it and say, I'm only going to study it here? And part of the problem is it's really hard to figure out, you know, besides like anecdotal evidence and things that seem different or feel different, you know, if there really is anything that's different. And political science was unique because one of the reasons Southern politics developed as a field, a separate field, is because it was a one-party system. It was completely Democrat for most of the 20th century and had an all-white primary and all of these voting restrictions that made it really tangibly distinct. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there's very little that is more than just kind of what we think and feel and what history shows. And so to actually be able to look and say what's still distinct, what's not distinct, with some survey data. And survey data can only go so far, but it gets us to think in places we wouldn't. For example, one of the very odd findings in the poll, or surprising findings, was that a larger percentage of African Americans than whites feel Southern. Well, what does that mean? What is that identity label? I mean, we don't have the answer in the poll of what that means. To a degree, we can figure out some characteristics, but it can launch a whole nother research agenda for someone else who wants to figure out what is the African American tie to the South. We've just assumed Southern means white, or some of us haven't, mm-hmm. but a lot of books, a lot of kind of popular understanding just assumes Southern means white, and now we know it very much doesn't. We know for a fact with numbers that that's not true, and we have to address that in some way as cultural critics and historians and political scientists.
Now, before we move on, you will have to define for me, oversample, mm-hmm. the South. What do you consider the South in your poll?
In our poll, we've used the states that seceded during the Civil War, the old Confederacy. There's great arguments for looking at adding in places like Oklahoma and other peripheral states. And we may consider those things in the future, but for this time, we wanted to really try to say, because a lot of the stuff that's written, it takes those old Southern states and said they have such a unique legal and political history, then this distinctiveness is maintained over time, and trying to see if that was true. So we went back to kind of the original definition of the South. And then oversample, you want to?
Maybe I can. Let me see if I can do oversample without any jargon. Okay. I'll try. But if I do some jargon, you point at me or something. Okay.
Okay.
Whenever you take a sample of people and you've got people you're talking to, the more of them you talk to, the more accurate you are about what they all believe as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you only have 10 people, say, representing African-American women, we don't feel very confident that we know what all African-American women think. So when you oversample, you're going back and finding more of those people in that particular group until you reach a point where you think, you know what, we're pretty confident now. We know what that group thinks.
The more people you have, the lower your kind of margin of error. It's weighted to reflect the national kind of percentages of South, inside South, outside South, African-American, Latino, white, all those kinds of things. So the more people we get, the more accurate we are.
Could you discuss more of your findings, your part?
Sure. We found that when you really measure the South and you include African Americans and Latinos, so not just the white South, racial attitudes, racism, racial prejudice is not that distinct from the rest of the country. When you pull out just white Southerners, it's kind of exactly what you would think it would be.
Hmm.
But overall, when you add in Latinos and African Americans, you get a true picture of the South. It's very, very similar to the rest of the country. Where it's completely different is on religion. Religiosity, when you compare and you include all of these groups and we have this great oversample and this small margin of error, it's just night and day. The numbers of people who are fundamentalists specifically, which literal interpretation of the Bible, hours per week devoted to their church, all of that kind of stuff is very different in the South than it is the rest of the country. So racism still distinct among white Southerners mm-hmm. from non-white non-Southerners, but religion kind of trumps everything is one of the kind of interesting findings. And then I've done some work on the Tea Party too, which is not a uniquely Southern phenomenon, but a lot of interesting things. And we weren't trying to study the Tea Party, but within this large national sample, we ended up getting a really good-sized sample of Tea Party members, and we had asked them all of these in-depth questions about their racial views and their views on different policy issues. And so we were able to really kind of give a strong profile of who they are and kind of what's driving their behavior and their frustrations and all that. So all of those findings were kind of embedded in this poll unexpectedly.
I was reading one of your articles that was on the Blair Rockefeller poll page on the UARC website, and it says, religion, not racism, maintains Southern distinctiveness, mm-hmm. but then Democrats could make inroads mm-hmm. in the South. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. The kind of understanding at this point is that the South is red or Republican, but we know that Obama won three Southern states, Virginia and North Carolina and Florida, and almost in Georgia. And though part of that was a large influx of registered African-American voters, it was also white voters. And when we look at who's not voting in the South, we pull those people out and see who they are. They're overwhelmingly Democrats. A lot are Latino, a lot are women, and that group is an untapped – they self-identify as Democrats, so they feel some kind of political connection to that party, but they're not being reached, they're not being communicated with, and they're not voting in really high numbers. So when I say Democrats can make inroads, part of the problem is if a region – and this was the problem vice versa – when Republicans couldn't make inroads in the South in the 30s, 40s, 50s mm-hmm. and tried, is that if you assume that the state is red or you assume that the region is red, Republican and Democrats don't try, they don't ever activate those people. I mean, right after the 2008 election, there was a map in the New York Times and it showed increase in Republican voting. So the redder you were on the map, not who won in your state, but which way you went, increased from 2004. And Arkansas was like a red bullseye in the middle of the state. And part of it is because Obama had no campaign here at all. And so that assumed redness is what keeps Democrats from making inroads when our numbers show there's a lot of people who could be kind of pulled into the party. And the Republicans knew this in the 50s and 60s, and it's exactly how they made a move to flip the South from Democrat to Republican. Mm-hmm. They knew they couldn't win a whole election, but they slowly gathered people into the party. And that's what it takes to have two-party competition again in the South, which we don't have in a lot of places right now. So it's either party can do it. It's just right now Democrats have kind of written off big chunks of the South, which our numbers show is a mistake.
Now, if we move on to the Tea Party movement, what is this fear of falling, which every Tea Party member talks about?
Well, we asked a lot of perspective questions of our survey participants. What do you think is going to happen in the future? Do you think your financial situation will get better, get worse? Or, do you think the country will get better, get worse, and so on? And though the Tea Party members, self-identified Tea Party members, are not disproportionately affected by the economy, I mean, in some cases they're doing much better than the rest of the country, mm-hmm. they are overwhelmingly negative about the future. They feel very afraid of their economic situation in the future. They're very afraid the direction the country is going. So it seems to be some kind of intangible fear that hasn't exactly happened yet, but they think is coming, and that's driving them to, into this organization, into this kind of movement.
Mm-hmm. Contrast that to a lot of the African Americans in the survey, their own financial situation, even their own employment situation is worse than much of the members of the Tea Party, but African Americans were more optimistic about their own personal future and the country's future. Whereas the Tea Party members personally are not – they're doing much better, but they're very afraid of where the country's going.
Even though they're doing well, a middle class, earn between $40,000 and $100,000 mm-hmm. and
– Have higher levels of education.
And very politically mm-hmm. sophisticated.
Very politically sophisticated and voting in record numbers.
Now, we know that the Tea Party members make up about 10.6% of the voting population. How influential are they?
Well, they're not just 10.6% of the voting population. They're 10.6% of the population, period, not just voting.
And that's defined very liberally, too. There would be some, like Dr. Maxwell was saying, is these are self-professed Tea Party members. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we took an encompassing view. So they would be 10% of the population from a very liberal counting.
Right. And then they vote, you know, in these kind of record numbers. I think that the Republicans have to deal with them. You know, I definitely think they're ultra conservative compared to kind of a moderate, typical average Republican. And the party has to decide if they're going to try to move farther to the right and absorb the Tea Party, mm-hmm. or if they're going – but they have to be careful, because if the Tea Party really is in a lot of ways triggered, or at least in some ways triggered by Obama, then we'll see their energy kind of dissipate when he goes out of office, whether that's in 2013 or in 2017. And so if the Republican Party moves too far to the right, then they're going to be left with a wide open middle. And that's going to be something Democrats can take advantage of. However, if they don't absorb enough Tea Party views and the Tea Party splits and runs third party candidates, not even at the national level, that would be, you know, very difficult for Republicans. But at state, in state elections, in, you know, U.S. House and Senate elections, that kind of stuff, if they're that dissatisfied, the Republican Party is walking this very, very, very fine line right now. And they're going to have to – and I think that's why we've seen so much confusion and so much frustration in the primaries, mm-hmm. and nobody really able to gain a footing very well with this, you know, with the party as a whole, because it's really kind of fighting for the future of the party right now. And so it doesn't surprise me that nobody's kind of risen up as the expected, you know, nominee at this point. I mean, it's still early, but there's not even really a – I mean, I guess maybe Newt now as a front runner, but nobody over the long haul. And different people leading in such different states is very odd. And so it'll be kind of interesting to see. So they are – they're very influential in terms of swaying who those Republican choices are going to be, because they're mm-hmm. a constant threat to break away. And if they take 5%, 6% of the party with them, it can be a game changer.